Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us our special guest this evening, Ron Brown, and we're going to be talking about money. But we've talked about money before. I really wanted to give you just a little different outlook on what's going on. Because, you see, if you look at things as everybody else looks at them, you're not going to be able to understand anything that's going on today. Before we came to the studio, I was reading an article about how communist China, now, of course, we never refer to it as communist China, but because, after all, we're supposed to believe communism is dead and doesn't exist anymore, and we won the Cold War, and now we have a new enemy. It's Al-Qaeda and the terrorists, and they're threatening to attack us at any time, and only they haven't even been able to find one terrorist willing to strap on explosives and go into a shopping center or something here in the United States. But, oh my goodness, we've got this terrible threat and we've got to give up our freedom here in America because Osama bin Laden's over there in a cave and we can't find Osama bin Laden. Of course, before he ever was behind the 9/11 attack, there were at least 11 or 12 times we could have taken Osama bin Laden or captured or killed him, but for some reason, American intelligence didn't want to. And then when we invaded Afghanistan in our war on terrorism, why, our military wasn't allowed to take him out. And if you doubt that, we have an article out of the Washington Times quoting one of the highest officials who said, our goal is not to get Osama bin Laden. After all, if we got Osama bin Laden, how would we justify the war? And if you'd like to see a copy of that article, why don't you call us at 1-800-544-8927. We'll be glad to send it to you. Of course, you'd like to get it in a book called Crude Politics, tells you the same story. But it's a book that the publisher just didn't bother to try to distribute, even though they printed 20,000 copies, and they've still got something like 15,000, and for some reason, they just didn't want to put that book out that said our forces weren't allowed to get Osama bin Laden. Well, nothing as it appears is as it appears to be, and you have to understand that carries over into money. Actually, communist China is buying up things all throughout South America, developing close financial relationships with Brazil and Venezuela, and of course, contracting to buy lots of the oil from Venezuela, which means, of course, we won't have access to it here. And where is China getting the money? Well, a lot of it is coming from China Petrol, the Chinese corporation. Where did they get their money? Why raise their money? They raised their funds on American financial markets probably 6 or 8 years ago so they could go into Saddam, so that they could finance the Sudanese government to kill the Christians, drive them out of their land, so that the Chinese communists could put in the oil wells in the southern of Sudan. And then, of course, the Chinese government continues giving money to Saddam, and they're using it then for their raids at Darfur and western Sudan, where they've killed 50 to 100,000 blacks. But, of course, where did the money come from? Originally came from the United States. But we never want to talk about that or how, you know, we've done everything we could to finance the communist Chinese, even within the last a few weeks of guaranteeing a $5 billion loan that's going to be given to the Chinese communists to build 5 nuclear power plants in China. Now, we can't have nuclear power plants in America, but they can build them there. The 5 are just the beginning of a 50 new nuclear power plants in China to build up their economy. And there's something wrong with this picture. Why are we actually lending, subsidizing through the World Bank, the IMF, which we control, many of our corporations that are going over and building their factories in communist China? It doesn't really make a sense unless there are a lot of things going on that are not supposed to make sense. We're going to be back here in just a moment, but let me just tell you a little bit about the background to money. It was Daniel Webster who said, "Of all the contrivances for cheating the laboring class of mankind, none has been more effective than that which deludes them with paper money. Of all the contrivances for cheating the laboring classes of mankind, none has been more effective than that which deludes them with paper money." What was he saying? Well, he's basically saying that bankers create money out of nothing, convince you it has some worth to it, and, of course, expand the economy, and everybody thinks that they're going to get on board and they're going to get rich, and everybody lives very well, and the stock market booms, and, well, this is exactly what happened in 1789 after the French Revolution, and, of course, it ended in disaster. And, of course, we've done exactly the same thing. We've created money with no backing for it. And as Aristotle said, and remember now, he lived about 300 years before Christ, there's nothing inherently wrong, in effect, with fiat money, provided we get perfect authority and godlike intelligence in kings. There's nothing inherently wrong, in effect, with fiat money, provided we get perfect authority and godlike intelligence for kings. And, of course, he's saying that with tongue-in-cheek, because we never get perfect authority, and we never get godlike knowledge for kings. And, unfortunately, why Aristotle had seen what had happened to ancient Greece. And, of course, you could fast-forward, and the same thing happened to ancient Rome, and the same thing is happening in America today. Now, people have to understand that our whole monetary system is built upon creating paper money and the process of usury. In other words, lending money for interest. And if you go into the background, Cicero, Cato, Seneca, all of the ancient philosophers condemn the concept of usury. The Old Testament forbids one Jew lending money to another Jew for interest. Even the Knights Templar, who are the most powerful occult force in the world during the 1200s, weren't allowed to charge interest on their money. The Quran, the Mohammedan faith, says that it is against Allah's will to have usury. And usury was condemned by the Catholic Church until the 1600s, when one of the leaders of the world occult movement, a man named Sir Francis Bacon, said that usury really would be pretty good. It would encourage commerce. And it was shortly after that that the Catholic Church accepted usury. And you have to understand that Sir Francis Bacon was the leader of the Rosicrucians. He was the leader of the Rosicrucians that sent a small group of men to America sometime between 1620 and 1640 to take charge of our government. And they did. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're just talking about the background and history of money and where these ideas of paper money came from, where the ideas of usury came from. And, of course, usury was never accepted by Christian civilization until shortly after Sir Francis Bacon, and this was in the early 1600s, because I think he died about 1620, till Sir Francis Bacon had actually come out in favor of usury, in violation of all the advice of the ancient philosophers, Cicero, Cato, Seneca, and of course it said, oh, usury would be wonderful because it will encourage commerce. In other words, by people being able to go out and borrow money and then pay interest on it, that money will allow more in the way of commerce. And so it was that usury came to be accepted. It was adopted by certain of the families in Florence and Venice, and even in the Netherlands, where banking began. But it was in 1694 in England when a man named William Paterson was given the charter for the Bank of England, which became the prototype for all of the central banks that dominate the world today. And I think Professor Quigley wrote it best, and those of you who have not read his book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, need to get a copy, but because this is what Professor Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor, a professor who had taught at both Harvard and Princeton before he went to Georgetown University, where he spent the latter part of his career. And Professor Quigley had studied the forces that have created the history of modern times. He was an elitist who believed we need an elite class. He had studied the secret society that Cecil Rhodes created that became the Council on Foreign Relations. But Professor Quigley wrote this on page 324 of his book. "The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalistic fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreement arrived at frequent private meetings and conferences. Each central bank sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans, to manipulate foreign exchanges, to influence the level of economic activity in the country, and to influence cooperative politicians by subsequent economic rewards in the business world. Have you noticed how often when a congressman retires, he stays on as a lobbyist, or he gets a job with a big company or a big insurance company or a big bank and he lives comfortably ever after? Have you ever noticed that the people go from the Federal Reserve System into the banking system and from the banking system into the Federal Reserve? Did you realize that the Federal Reserve is not a branch of the United States government? It is a privately owned central bank, as are all the other central banks of the world today. And they all work in concert. They are motivated by dark spiritual forces. And if you'd like to get into the background and document really the background of banking, we have two sections. We have some articles we wrote in September and October of the year 2004. You can go to our website at radioliberty.com and pull them down, and then I think there are two letters in the 2002, three letters actually in 2002, that will give you the entire story of the occult spiritual forces behind the world banking system that is leading us, America, to financial collapse and the world into a new world order and a new world religion. I would simply point out that Paul Volcker, former chairman of the Federal Reserve System, long time associated with Chase Manhattan Bank, one of the leaders of this whole cabal that rules the world. Paul Volcker wrote an article that appeared in the Washington Post on the 10th of this month, this 10th of April, in which he said that we're skating on thin ice. That basically what's happening is we're spending too much money. There's no incidents in all history where a nation spends more than 6% of its gross domestic product more every year than it's taking in. In other words, we have a massive trade imbalance. He said this can't go on. The American people have no savings. We are simply hemorrhaging money out of our country. And as he basically said, you know, if something is not done, the whole thing is going to collapse. He said, you know, it'll happen sooner or it'll happen later. He doesn't know when it's going to happen. But he here's a man who headed the Federal Reserve System, did the right thing back in 1980, and saved our economy. And then he concluded by saying that it is often said that what needs to be done now is seldom done now, is usually put off until later, and later is often too late. He concluded by saying, I would hate to think that would be the epitaph for America. This is one of the men who rules the world financially. He attends all of the international financial meetings. When our friend Joan Vian saw him at one of these meetings about 6 months ago and asked him what was going on as far as the world financial system, he said, we've done a very, very poor job. Why we're going to have to come up with a new system. And then, of course, what they really are planning on coming up with, after America's financial system has collapsed, after the savings of the people of this country have been destroyed, is a cashless society. I'm firmly convinced that's what they intend. And after all, then you'll neither buy nor sell, unless you mark where the mark of the beast or be known by the number of his name. And already up in Washington or Oregon, why they're chipping the children that are actually going to school, so that when they go through the line at the to get their lunch at the school, they just wave their hand over the little reader. And in fact, our good friend Tom Horn has written an article about that. We hope to have him on our program sometime soon. They're actually doing this, you know, just trying to see if the American people will accept it. I'm sure they will. It'll be very convenient. It'll all be done on a debit basis, and the government is going to provide and control each one of us. Our guest this evening is Ron Brown. Ron, how are you doing?
It's fine, Dr. Stan.
Well, tell us what's happening in the financial markets, because I know you watch them very, very closely, and I know a lot of people are watching them, but they can't make any sense out of it, because the market goes up one day, goes down. It was down here almost below 10,000 a couple of weeks ago, and then suddenly it's rallied back up again. This is all manipulation, isn't it?
Well, of course. But, you know, just to tie into what you were saying, I think it's becoming rather obvious to anyone who studies the market that the financial system we've been under since 1913 is about to run its course. We're running into a train wreck. This whole system is about to implode. And, of course, as you know, as you've been discussing, the insiders are doing this for a purpose because they have their agenda, and their agenda is a one-world central bank and then eventually the cashless society you're talking about. So I think this system we're in now, this crisis we're heading to, we're just living on borrowed time. But yes, all the central banks of the world, in my opinion, and in your opinion, obviously you just said it, are part of the same international banking community, and they have their own agenda, and they work together, and all these G7 meetings and the private meetings they have, I'm sure, are to discuss the strategy of how they're going to take the dollar down. But if you'll just go back to December, just to give you an idea of the manipulation, you know, the dollar had started into another downspin about a month before the election, about in October. The dollar index was trading somewhere around 89, and by December, a month after the election, the dollar index was at 80, or right at 80, ready to break through a 10-year major support level. And if that would have happened, you would have seen a panic out of the dollar, and everything would have accelerated very, very quickly, and it would have just fed into all the markets. So at that point, the central banks, who are really trying to dump their dollars, must come to the rescue of the dollar. I think they all come in and they start buying dollars to prop up the dollar temporarily. Now, here's how they manipulate the silver market in particular. The international bankers, such as Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, etc., as you said, they're all part of the same fraternity. They are the group that is shorting the silver market. They're selling paper silver on the COMEX, and that's where the price for silver is derived, out of the COMEX. So in December, when gold was at 455 and rising, the dollar was down to 80 and ready to collapse, silver was above $8 and ready to blow to the upside. Those banks that short the market were short approximately approaching 600 million ounces of silver on the COMEX.
Now, of course, there aren't 600 million ounces of silver available in the world, are there?
No, there's only about 40 million ounces of deliverable silver on the COMEX. So obviously, one, their purpose is not to make a profit in silver, it's to manipulate, because you can't short more than exists. But they were very vulnerable at that point. But when the central banks come in to prop up the dollar, since gold and silver act primarily on the weakness of the dollar, then that takes a little pressure off the gold market and the silver market temporarily. And at that point is when these bullion bankers, the Morgan Chases of the world, start to sell silver on the COMEX. And if that won't do it, they sell some more. And if that won't do it, they sell some more. And they just keep the selling pressure up until they finally break the backs of these speculators on the long side, the tech funds and so forth. And, of course, the tech funds are working with limited money, where these international bankers are working with unlimited funds.
Because they can create money out of nothing through this phony paper banking
system. It's the equivalent of you and I collecting $10,000 and going to Vegas and walking into one of the big casinos and say, give me a house game. You know, you've got 10,000 going up against 50 million, you're not going to win. And so that's what they do, is they manipulate the futures market and force them out. And once they start them out, then we go into a margin massacre where the loans are called in, and of course it just feeds on itself.
And I think that this is the same pattern of things that have been done, whether it be in the silver market, the general market as a whole. You go back and you study the history of the economics of the United States, and you find, for instance, during the 1800s, that the bankers created instance after instance after instance of financial crises. In other words, they'd expand the monetary supply, and then they'd contract the monetary supply. And when they contracted the monetary supply, everybody who'd borrowed money, the way they would simply foreclose on the loans, there wasn't any money out there. People lost their homes, their factories, their farms, over and over again. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're simply talking about how this monetary system has been exploited through the years by the bankers, and really by the central bankers. What most people don't understand, there are spiritual forces behind the international banking system, and you can trace this all the way back to Sir Francis Bacon back in the 1600s, but I'm sure we could really trace it back to the Templars. We could trace it back to the Temple when Jesus was there. Of course, drove the money changers out of the temple because they were exploiting the people. And we could take this back into ancient Egypt and ancient Rome. There's really goes back to ancient Babylon. There's always been coinage. There's always been manipulation of the public through the monetary system. And this is what people really don't understand. They can see the result of the monetary system. They can see how it's possible now with our fiat money system, our banking system, to create money out of nothing, but they don't understand the spiritual component, really, that energizes this whole scenario, and that I believe is leaving this country towards its punishment for turning its back on God, and that is that we are going to see a financial collapse in this country. Now, one of the most interesting things, Ron, is a recent speech by Alan Greenspan, where he was talking, first of all, about the fact that we have real problems with Social Security. We're going to have to cut Social Security payments, and we're going to have to cut Medicare payments. And, of course, nobody wants to talk about that. No politicians would dare to suggest that. But Alan Greenspan said that, and then he said something that came as a real shock to me. He said China is going to revalue their currency sooner rather than later. Now, how would Alan Greenspan know that China is going to revalue their currency, increase the value of their currency, which will, of course, make their goods more expensive here in the United States, which will mean that we'll be buying fewer of the cars that they produce? And why would China do something to help stabilize the American economy, at least on a temporary basis? It's certainly, they can still, even if they revalue their currency about 25%, why they're still going to be able to, outproduce us, because, of course, they have such cheap labor. But did you pick up on that article at all on Alan Greenspan predicting that the Chinese communists are going to revalue their currency to help the United States? That doesn't make sense.
Well, I didn't hear it from Greenspan, but I'd heard other talk about it. In fact, talk I heard was going to revalue it by 6%, but that, and even that would have an impact on us, but I think 25% is more likely. I mean, we've already sent all of our jobs over there, so we can't compete with them anyway.
And, of course, it was really so interesting recently when the President of the United States was asked about General Motors, which lost $1 billion this last quarter, and, of course, they're losing money, a couple of billion dollars last year in Europe. Their bonds are down to really the level of junk bonds. They've got to raise something like $30 to $40 billion, in bonds to pay off the bonds that they already have in the next 6 to 9 months. And the question is, who's going to buy General Motors bonds? General Motors is facing a collapse. And when the President in the United States was asked, oh, what about General Motors? What is the government going to do to help them? The President's response was, they're going to have to learn to compete. Now, a decade and a half ago, when Chrysler was facing problems, while the government gave them a guaranteed loan and would not allow Chrysler to go down. But everything seems to have changed, and we'll be back in just a moment to explore this. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we're simply talking about what's really going on behind the scenes here today. And I was just commenting that the terrible straits that General Motors is in. I know we have listeners in the Detroit area, the Michigan area, and one of the things that has been pointed out is, of course, General Motors lost $1 billion, that's B billion dollars, this last quarter. They lost a couple of $1 billion in Europe last year. Their bonds, the value of their bonds has been put down to just about the level of junk bonds. They're going to have to then pay very high interest rates. They owe something like $17 billion to their pension fund that Monday they just don't have, and yet that's required, because they'd like, of course, to get out from underneath that so that they can begin to show profits. But by government law, by federal law, they're required to fund their pension fund. So General Motors is in real trouble. And when the President of the United States was asked by a reporter within the last couple of days, what are we going to do to help General Motors? After all, years ago, why, when Chrysler was facing a similar situation, why the United States gave them a guaranteed loan, the President of the United States, speaking of General Motors, said, they've got to learn to compete. How would you respond to that? What do you think he's talking about, Ron?
Well, let me just, a little side note on the GM situation, because I think you can take what's happening with GM and look at every corporation in America. Part of their problem, I read, was that they are trying to pay health benefits and pension plans for 461,000 former employees or their spouses. Now, if you were the actuary 20 years ago trying to prepare for the retirement for the people today, and the medical, what was the medical insurance back then? $100 a month or something?
Right, something like that.
Here we are 20 years later, and it's $400 to $500 a month. There is nothing GM could have done to plan for what actually came down. So I think you could take that dilemma that all corporate America has to be facing, is that their pension plans or retirement plans cannot cover what the costs are. And so something has to give. In a private economy or a free economy, under any criteria you'd want to judge it, GM is totally bankrupt. But could they, the president may say he's not going to bail them out, but if GM were to allow to do what they should be allowed to do, and that is go bankrupt, what impact would that have on the U.S. economy?
I think it would have had a profound impact. In fact,
we're devastated.
I mean, so, what you're talking about, they're one of the largest employers in the United States today.
That's right. So what I'm saying is, President Bush may be saying that they're not going to do anything, but they cannot let them fail. Because, as you know, I've said time after time on your show that what we have is our monetary system has really become a Ponzi scheme. It must keep growing. You cannot allow it to contract, or the whole thing will implode on itself overnight. So that's the dilemma we're in. It's inflate or die, and they have to bail out whatever would fail to keep the system going.
Well, of course, the thing is, there is a federal agency that guarantees the pension benefits to corporate employees when they retire. That's known as the Pension Benefit Guarantee Program, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Program. And so all the corporations pay into this federal agency so that if one of the companies does go down, there'll be enough money to bail out the pension funds. The only trouble is that the pension benefit agency today, benefit guarantee agencies, about $23 billion in the hole right now. In other words, they've got $23 billion more in obligations that they have already had to take on that they don't have the money to pay. And, of course, if they would have to pick up the $17 billion for GM, why, that would just push them right over the edge. And the trouble is more and more of our major corporations go bankrupt. Why, the pension benefit guarantee corporation is going to have to pick up about $500 billion of pension benefits, and where is the money going to come from? Well, it's going to have to come simply out of the United States Treasury. I think what President Bush is really saying, if the only way that General Motors can compete with China is to move their factories to China. They've already opened factories in China. They have a number of factories over there and places where they can actually produce GM parts. Now, I don't think that they're producing and planning on producing large numbers of cars in China to sell to the Chinese. I think they're planning on producing large numbers of cars in China to put on boats and bring over here and sell here so they don't have to produce in Detroit, where the average pay and benefits is about $27 an hour. It's a lot cheaper to buy, hire somebody over in China at 50 cents an hour, and that's how you compete. But, of course, George Bush is not going to tell the American people what they're really planning. This is going to decimate certainly Ontario and Illinois and Michigan and all those states in that area. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is one of my favorite guests, and that's Ron Brown. And we're sort of talking about really what's going on financially here in the United States as more and more of our corporations are being forced to go into areas where there's a low wage base, where you can hire people at 50 cents an hour, 75 cents an hour. And what this is really is all about of this master plan of the people who really run the world and work in concert with the central banks. And it's all laid out in something called the Earth Charter. If you have not read the Earth Charter, you need to get a copy. You can pull it down off of the Internet, or if you don't have access to the Internet, you can call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And as you read through the Earth Charter, and it has all this sort of a sentimental gobbledygook and world government and brotherhood and feel-good sort of things, but read point 10, where they talk about redistributing the wealth within nations and between nations. Redistributing the wealth between nations. What are they really talking about? They're talking about redistributing the wealth of the American people, not the wealth of the elite, but the wealth of the American people and destroying the middle class. That's how you bring down a country. And, of course, when we go into economic chaos, which I feel is planned, I believe that's what the Office of Homeland Security is really all about. It's not about the threat of Osama bin Laden living a cave in Pakistan. But they know when this economy goes into a tailspin, there are going to be people out in the streets, and, well, they're already preparing for that. They're federalizing the local police, and the local police are working closely with the FBI, supposedly in the name of controlling illegal immigration and other things. But it's really all that. So we will have a federal police force in every city rather than a local police force, which was the hallmark of a free society and of a free America. So I think that the people in charge know exactly what's going to happen. That's why they passed this new bankruptcy law, so that you're not going to be able to get out from all of the debts. And if you're in debt, ladies and gentlemen, today, why, you're in real trouble. Because when this economy goes into a tailspin, there is no way to get out from underneath that debt. And that debt will follow you wherever you are and wherever you work for the rest of your life. And, of course, with interest rates, they can go up, you know. And, of course, you'll be like the people in the third world countries are, the third world nations, simply paying interest on the debt, never getting to pay off the principal. So understand that the people in charge know exactly what's going to happen. That's why they passed the new bankruptcy laws. That's why they've taken down the tariffs. That's why they're doing everything they can to shift our factories and our jobs out of this country. We'll be right back here. Well, our guest is Ron Brown. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Ron certainly supports Radio Liberty. He's been in the business of watching the economy and dealing with coins for a long period of time. And Ron, before I forget, why don't you get your telephone number out so people, if they'd like to get the material that you offer, they can get it from you.
My name is 1-800-595-0561. That's 1-800-595-0561.
Well, what have your take on what's going on at the present time? You know, certainly we seem to be going up. The market's up one day, down the next day. The gold market's up a little. The gold market's down. The same thing as silver. It's obviously they're being manipulated by the people who really control our economy. The price of course, natural resources are up because of the tremendous demand coming from China and from India, that suddenly these nations that have been living in poverty are beginning to come into the moving towards first world. The people are getting cars, they're getting a higher living standard, but it's all being, of course, bought by lowering the living standards of the average American. And one of the things that seems to be a very legitimate concern is the fact that the American people have almost no savings. Have you run into this?
Well, absolutely. You know, you just look at everyone you talk to, you know, as they prepare us for bondage with their bankruptcy laws, they're making it easier and easier and easier over the last 10, 15 years for people to go in debt. You know, I was talking to someone just recently who bought a house in California of $500,000+, zero down payment, interest-only loan. You know, when you talk about this bankruptcy you're talking about, when the dot-com bubble burst back in year 2000, a lot of people lost 50, 60, 70% of their savings. But, you know, if you go into debt on a house for $500,000 and this bubble pops, which it certainly will, and that house suddenly becomes a $300,000 house or $100,000, who knows where it'll go, then that person has sold himself in bondage because they'll never pay themselves out of that debt. And that's what's so frightening and sad about the people that are just rushing out headlong to get into debt beyond their easy, because they make it so easy and people feel so rich because they're driving around in new SUVs and, you know, we got a new boat in the garage and the whole bit, but it's all on debt. And it's, the bubble has to pop, and it's frightening to think what it's going to do to the average American.
Well, of course, I think one thing that they intend to do is drive up the prices of the things we are importing from other countries. That is why, of course, China has agreed to revalue their currency, so their products will become somewhat more expensive. We will not be buying so many things that are coming from overseas because they're such a good bargain, you just can't pass them up. They're so cheap, why, it's almost like you have to get them. And so they are hoping that by driving up the prices of the products we are buying, that we are importing, that the American people then will begin to save some of their money. But I think that they've created such a spendthrift attitude on the part of the American people, like, oh, we're going to spend it because, like, there is no tomorrow. And I think a lot of the American people have lost their sense of responsibility that they, if they're going to be free people, have to be prepared to look after themselves and to take care of themselves, and they can't look to government for their security. There are an awful lot of people who are not putting anything away for their retirement because they think they're going to get Social Security and they're going to have Medicare and all of these wonderful things. And I got news for you. Alan Greenspan has said, and I believe it, that they're not going to be there. And I don't care what George Bush says about trying to modify Social Security, there is no way that you could save the Titanic once the hull was ripped open. And I don't think there's any way you can save the welfare program we've established here in America. I think it's not a matter of, as Paul Volcker said, of if, but when this whole thing is going to come down. The whole house of cards, and all we would need to be a terrorist attack. All we would need would be a nuclear attack from Iran or from North Korea, or a couple of our airlines to be shot down. And of course, it wouldn't necessarily have to be even done by terrorists. It could be that it was time to have another crisis, and, well, we would not say necessarily who would be responsible, but whoever was responsible, why, we would always be able to blame the wicked Osama bin Laden for the financial catastrophe. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Ron, do you have any idea of the timing of what's going to lie ahead?
You know, let's look at this bull market in gold, and you could look at it also from the other side, the bear market assets, from an Elliott Wave perspective. Now, I'm not a student of Elliott Wave from a technical standpoint, because it gets into mathematical formulas that, you know, way beyond me, but what to me Elliott Wave describes very clearly is the psychology of markets. So what Elliott Wave theory says is that all bull markets, doesn't matter whether you're talking gold, soybeans, real estate, stock market, or whatever, they go up in five distinctive wave patterns. In other words, you would have an initial up wave, a correction wave, a second up wave, second correction wave, and then the final blow-off wave. Psychologically, if you think about it, when you go into the beginning of the, let's say, the new bull market in gold and silver, prior to that, gold had done literally nothing for 20 years. So no one was really looking at gold, and the only people that got involved in the early stages of the gold bull market was the smart money, the people who studied it. The masses had no idea that gold was even a good investment back when it was $250, you know, in 2001. So in my opinion, the first leg of Elliott Wave theory started in 2001 when gold bottomed at $255, silver was somewhere around $4, and over the next 3 years to April of last year is when I think we'll look back and say that's when the first wave ended. Gold went from $255 to $455, and silver went from $4 to $850. And if you remember back in April a year ago is when they came in and just hammered the market, dropped silver from $850 down to $550, and gold went down too. And then for the last year, it's been a battle where, in effect, all the powers to be in Washington and Wall Street and the central banks, they've called out all the king's horses and all the king's men to try to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And so for the last year, we've been in what I call the correction phase. But as most of the people out there notice, Humpty Dumpty ain't going back together again. So now the deficits are spinning out of control. Foreigners, every day we hear someone else back off of the dollar. I think it was just this week, wasn't it, that Russia came out and said they were going to change their reserve percentage from 10% to 30% in the euro, which means they're going to be dumping their dollars, right? So as the people accelerate out of the dollar, I think we're on the verge within a month or so of going into the second leg up. Now, the second leg is when, one, the institutions start to jump on board. And you're already seeing that. You're seeing more advertisements for gold and silver. You're seeing these new ETF funds where you can now buy gold and silver in mutual funds. But it's also the wave when the average person, I call it the Lilliputian revolution, when the little folks start to wake up to inflation. And I really don't know how anyone can ignore inflation today. You know, if you go to the grocery store and you stop to fill up the car along the way and you're paying $2.69 or whatever you're paying out in California for gasoline, and you stop by the post office on the way to the grocery store and you get two notices that your insurance for health insurance or car insurance or whatever is going up, that they're raising it, and then when you get to the store you're paying $3.80 for a pound of tomatoes, all of a sudden people are saying, you know, they're telling me that there's only 2% inflation, but the cost of my living is going up 10-15% a year. And at that point, people must and they will change the way they invest. You cannot leave your money tied up in a CD or a T-bill at 3-3.5% once you understand inflation is running at 10%. And that's when the people will start to pull out of the banks, take their CDs, and start putting them into gold and silver and other investments. Unfortunately, most people think real estate is a tangible. But real estate's so overvalued now and everything is about mortgages that real estate really isn't a true tangible in today's market.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. I think that, the real estate market is just so inflated. I mean, I think that houses are wonderful, but they have to be some relationship between the price that you pay and their inherent value. And you want to buy something that's undervalued, not something that's overvalued. And I think one of the last great bubbles is the housing market bubble. And it's really amazing how they've been able to use the housing market bubble to increase liquidity. In other words, there's no real increase in the value of a house. It's simply that people are willing to pay more for it. And as long as people are willing to pay more for it, and then the loan companies will say, well, gee, this house is worth much more. Now, it's really not worth any more than it was, 20 years ago. It's the same house. But they have created this perception that it's worth so much more, and they'll lend you this money, and that money then can be put into the market, increasing the liquidity of the entire market, and, of course, that money then is spent over and over again. But what happens if the value of the property begins to decline? And then, of course, they begin to call in the loans, and all of these people have revalued their homes, and suddenly they're going to have to come up with money to, and they're going to have to either pay back the money. Of course, most of them they'll be paying other adjustable rate mortgages, but those adjustable rate mortgages can keep going up and up and up to the point where it becomes just prohibitively expensive to pay back the loan, and many people are not going to be able to. And all you need to do is begin to see a cascading of defaults on property, and then the whole housing market comes down. It has happened before. It happened in Japan in the early 1990s. And the people who were buying property over there, and the property had just gotten so completely out of bounds. You know, a little tiny house over there was, you know, on a tiny postage stamp sized piece of property was $1 million or $2 million, and people were buying them one day and making profit and selling them the next, almost like they're doing in America today with houses in many parts of the country, where you buy a house and you never even move into it. You turn around and sell it and you've made $50,000 or $100,000, and then you buy another house. But it's these speculative booms, and when that bubble bursts, why, hold on to your hat. And I feel that an awful lot of people are going to be wiped out when this speculative boom bursts, when the bubble bursts. And I think that you're seeing more and more being written about the housing bubble and the fact it's going to burst. And aren't you concerned about that, Ron, and the implications of the evaporation of this liquidity? It never was real. It was all a matter of perception. It was all a facade, but people believed it, and it appeared to be real. But when that liquidity disappears, all this liquidity that's there that never really existed, it was all a matter of perception, when that disappears, what that's going to do to the to our economy and to the market as a whole?
Yeah, let's put it in, just to go back a little bit. Remember, I've been saying this whole thing is a Ponzi scheme. You have to keep the system growing. Well, think back to 1978, 79. We had Carter in office, and remember the guns and butter years of President Johnson. And we went into an inflationary blow off, and in 1980, they lost it. Interest rates went up to 21%, inflation was out of control, the dollar was in a collapse, and then Reagan came into office, and they were trying, and Paul Volcker was trying to get things back under control. And in 1982 is when Ronald Reagan, and I remember when he did it, June the 21st, he came out and gave a speech, and basically he said, and I'll paraphrase, he said, "Damn the torpedoes, folks, we're going to print our way out of this mess." And what he did was literally open the money spigots up, start the inflationary process, got America into a booming economy. The rest of the world desperately needed to trade with us. So for 20 years, we had a blast because the whole world was willing to finance our deficits and come in our markets, and the stock market went into a boom, and the Dow went from 780 in 1980, 82, and by, 2000, it was at 12,000. And so that was a bubble that kept this thing growing. And during that period when all the stocks were going up, the pension plans were doing great because their investments were doing fine. But it was an artificial bubble, and it popped. And when it popped, it almost took us in a total deflationary depression. So they had to come up with another bubble, and that was the real estate bubble, see? So for the last 5-6 years, they've used the real estate bubble to reinflate the economy. But it's gotten so ridiculous. What is their next bubble they can create? I don't know that there is one. I think we're getting close to the end, and this whole Ponzi scheme is about to collapse, as all Ponzi schemes do.
But of course, it's this whole idea of paper money, and I started out by quoting Daniel Webster. "Of all the contrivances for cheating the laboring classes of mankind, none has been more effective than that which deludes them with paper money." And people have to understand that this is not the first time this has happened. It happened in ancient Greece, happened in ancient Rome a couple of times. It has happened time and time and time again. It's just that nobody has ever told them what happens when this whole thing falls apart. Whether it be John Law in France in 1718, whether it be the United States in 1776 in the Continental Paper, whether it be France again in 1789 when they went into a paper economy, or whether it be in the United States in the mid-century when we had the Civil War and they began to try to finance the war with the greenbacks and Lincoln's greenbacks. We saw what happened in America, the United States, certainly after the First World War and the inflation spiral that they created, and then, of course, the Federal Reserve destroyed that inflationary spiral in 1929. They did it intentionally. And, of course, we saw what happened in Germany during the same time when they tried to pay off their debts with worthless money, and they paid off their war debts, and in the process they ended up destroying the economy of Germany and ended up with Adolf Hitler. People say it can't happen here, and I would like to say, why can't it happen here? And I'm reminded of what Alexander Tyler wrote, and he was a historian who taught at Edinburgh University, and in 1787, the very year that the United States wrote the Constitution in Philadelphia, Alexander Tyler said this: "Democracies are temporary forms of government. They last only until the people find they can vote themselves into the largest of the public treasury. People vote for politicians who promise to give them the most. The country goes bankrupt and, of course, goes into chaos and is replaced by a dictatorship." Could that happen here, Ron?
Well, it's going to happen here because we've already set the stage for it, and you can see that the government claiming more power every day. They use every little crisis to create more power for themselves. And when the whole system collapses, you can imagine the totalitarian regime that will have to come in to take over.
And they already understand that, ladies and gentlemen. That's what the Office of Homeland Security is about. Do you really think that we are protecting us from the terrorists? Why aren't there more terrorist attacks in the United States? It's been almost 4 years since we've had a major terrorist attack in the United States. Is this all illusion and delusion? Is it real? Or are they preparing for what they know is going to happen when our economy collapses? Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Ron Brown, and we've got Eric calling from Compton. Hey, hi, Eric. How are you doing? I'm sorry I missed you the other day when you called. You have a question for our guest? Yeah, hi, Eric. How are you doing?
Okay, Mr. Brown, how's it going?
Just fine.
I'm the Eric that called you earlier in the week.
Oh, okay.
You know what? I have a dear brother that lives across the street from me. He's very knowledgeable when it comes to Bible prophecy, and he thinks that we're going to be raptured before things get too serious, and I'm not much on, I don't know much about the rapture. That's not my expertise, area of expertise, and I don't know, how would you respond to that? He's not worried about it. He thinks God's going to get us out of here before all this stuff starts to collapse. I'm not so convinced. How would I respond to him?
How do you respond to him, Ron?
I wouldn't argue with anyone that there won't be a rapture. What I would argue with is that the way it is taught in America, I would almost argue that it comes straight out of Satan. Because what it does is tell Christians, you do not have to be salt, you do not have to be light, you do not have to be involved. You just chill out because you're one of the chosen ones and you won't suffer any pain. Well, you can look around the world and Christians around the world are suffering pain all the time. So to me, what it does is tell Christians to sit on their tail and not be involved.
And I would simply respond to him, you know, the Christians in Germany felt exactly the same thing when Adolf Hitler was coming to power. How do you know that the rapture won't come 30 years after America has fallen? Where in the scripture does it say that America is going to be saved and not going to have to, as a nation, pay for its sins against God? So what are you going to say to your children and your grandchildren if you do nothing now and the rapture comes 30 years after America's fallen? And see what response you'll get from that. Because, you see, don't argue the rapture with them. Argue the timing on it.
That's right.
Yeah, well, that's where we disagreed.
All right. And the other thing is, of course, we could spend a lot of time talking about the Schofield Bible and how that was really where the whole idea of the rapture came in. This is a fairly new idea. This has not been around, you know, going back to the time of the Church Fathers, but it's something that really came out about in the 1800s. And it's sure been used very effectively to neutralize the Christian population. There, I hope and pray that he's right.
That's what
happens
I told
if he's wrong?
That's what I told. I hope you're right.
Right.
You don't want to be wrong. I don't. You might want to get somebody on your show and let that be a topic of discussion, and some expert in that area, Dr. Stan. I don't know, just a suggestion.
Okay, God bless
you. God bless you guys.
Thank
Take
you
care.
So very much. It's so good to hear from you, Eric.
Bye-bye.
And we're going to, of course, get to Tony in just a moment, who's calling in from Soquel. And but we just have to bring our stations back on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and before we go on, Ron, I'm going to have to let you go here in just a minute, but let's get out your telephone number one more time.
Okay, I put out some reports that I've written, and if anyone would like a free copy, just call me at 1-800-595-0561. That's 1-800-595-0561.
All right, fine, and we've got Tony calling from SoCal, and we ordinarily don't take calls this late, but since it's Tony, well, we're going to let him on. Hi, Tony, how you doing?
I'm trying to make it fast. I wanted to ask a question about Warren Buffett and AIG, but I got to make a comment on the last caller, and it's like the debate over the rapture has been going on since the first century, and you know, because Paul wrote about it in 1 Thessalonians. And in 2 Thessalonians, he clarifies it, and he said, you know, there's going to be, I think it's chapter 2, if I remember right. He said, two things must happen first before the rapture takes place. First, there must be the apostasia, or the falling away of the church, and then the man of perdition who exalts himself above God must sit in the temple of God, blasphemes God, and declares himself to be God. Now, that hasn't happened yet. And from the way I see it in the book of Revelation, it says that that Antichrist person is going to put his figure in the temple of God, and then the false prophet is going to give it the power to speak, and when it speaks, it said all must worship the Antichrist and take the mark of the beast or die. So that hasn't happened yet, and I don't think the United States or anybody else is going to escape it.
All right.
So
you've got to escape the coming of catastrophe. Speak up.
Well, nobody's getting out of here until then. And personally, I wouldn't want to, because, I mean, God wants his church to stand up and declare his kingdom and declare who he is. And if the church can't do that, then they don't deserve to be in a better place.
Okay.
But anyway, as far as Ted Butler and AIG, AIG used to be the big kingmaker in the silver market, and they checked out, and now they're being investigated by Elliot Spitzer, and I keep seeing Warren Buffett's name coming up. And I was just wondering if you knew anything about what's going on with Buffett and AIG, or if it's just a bunch of smoke. That's my question. Thank
okay,
you.
Do you know anything at all about Warren Buffett and AIG?
Well, all I know is that we know the story that how he came in and bought 130 million ounces of silver. He did that back in, 97, 98. And then silver went to 8, and then he came out and admitted he was the one that bought all the gold and silver. I'm convinced at that point they called him on the carpet. And he was coerced into, at the very least, leasing his silver out. Now, when Enron went under later, the word was out, and you never get any official confirmation of all these things, so it's kind of conjecture, but it's kind of educated, you know, conjecture, is that Enron and Warren Buffett were using the same commodity broker in London, and that Enron did indeed lease 50 million ounces of Warren Buffett's silver. Now, if that did happen, what happened is Warren Buffett sitting there with a piece of paper for that 50 million ounces. Enron went out and sold that silver to use the proceeds for their brilliant trading strategies, of course, which went sour. So if that's the case, Warren Buffett, that silver's already in the market, never to return. So my guess is that Warren Buffett may have a position in silver, but he doesn't own as much physical silver as people give him credit for.
Okay, fine. Well, we're out of time. Thanks very much, Ron, and I appreciate so much you being with us, and we'll be talking to you again next month.
It's always a pleasure, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan. Hope you enjoyed our program. Ron is certainly one of the more astute observers. Let me simply mention, if you want to understand what's going on, we carry a wonderful book. It was written in 1891, 114 years ago. It's called The Final Battle. And Paul and Lorraine Walters have reproduced that book. We think it's an important book. If you have not yet read The Creature from Jekyll Island, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy by Professor Sutton, Gold for Survival and Gold for Investment by Professor Sutton, two books, and, of course, The Fiat Money Inflation in France, they're all available from Radio Liberty, and we'll be back in the next hour. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but it's 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us Andrew Skousen, Joel Skousen's son, and of course he and his brother Derek post up on the internet the material you'll find on World Affairs Brief, a fascinating overview of what's going on every day. I go there because then I don't have to peruse the Asia Times and of course the other publications from around the world, which I would have difficulty finding anyway, but their lead articles from so many of the major news sites are reproduced there and gives you an excellent overview of what's going on. And you miss very, very little if you read World Affairs Brief every morning, as I do. And, of course, then you read the World Affairs Brief commentary that's put out every Friday by Joel. And then, of course, you've been listening to our programs with Andrew and with Derek. So, Andrew, how are you tonight? It's good to have you with us.
Just fine, Dr. Stan. Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, tell us what the latest issues are and what's going to be covered in this week's World Affairs Brief.
All right. Well, this brief is kind of concentrated on some of the politics going on in South America right now. And I hope to do somewhat justice to all of the information that is in the brief this week about that. Maybe if we have time, we'll also talk a little bit about Social Security.
All right, go ahead.
All right, well, my father is the editor-in-chief of World Affairs. I've spent quite a bit of time in South America. He speaks fluent Spanish as well as Portuguese, and so he is quite interested in the culture and has spent a lot of time down there, and so he's pretty interested in what's going on, and it's a very interesting battleground, shall we say, right now between both the causes of liberty as well as some of the factions between who is going to have ultimate control down there.
And of course, now we see, of course, the Marxists are taking over country after country. They've taken over Brazil. They've taken over Chile. They've taken over Venezuela. So a couple of the other countries there. And of course, there's a war that's going on in Colombia. But, you know, certainly we find the Chinese communists are beginning, of course, to infiltrate that whole area and signing treaties with Brazil, signing treaties with Venezuela. And actually, it looks like they're going to compete with the United States for that oil. And we're so dependent upon the oil from Venezuela because we've not been allowed to develop our own oil facilities here or put in our nuclear power plants or develop the natural gas here. And if China begins getting all that oil from Venezuela, aren't we going to be in an awful lot of trouble?
It's true. And in fact, my father, the more that he researches this, is actually more concerned about this. He's convinced that there's a part of the Russian-Chinese axis of evil is influencing each of these countries' falls into Marxism and the subsequent challenge to any influence that the U.S. might have down there.
All right.
It's going to be very interesting to see what happens there.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment with Andrew Skousen, and we're going to be talking about what's really going on here in the South and Central America. Because, of course, at one time we had a Monroe Doctrine. Our leaders have abandoned that. And, of course, there's a very close alliance between Hugo Chavez of Venezuela and Fidel Castro of Cuba. And what does that mean to you? Well, Andrew, why don't you pick up the story from there?
Yeah, all right. First of all, I'd like to mention some of the forewarnings at the beginning of this story. My father is particularly keen about the potential impact of things going on south of the border. He thinks that it's a wise idea actually for most people to start boning up on Spanish if they can, because he predicts that there will be even dual language requirements within a decade. And he's not just talking about Florida and California. Both Republicans and Democrats, as most people know, are working toward open borders with Mexico. And the U.S., as many people have noted, is on its fast track to losing a cultural and constitutional identity.
And I don't think this is happening by accident. I think it's happening by intent. And the sooner our citizens understand that the leaders of both political parties are dedicated to this concept of bilingualism and the destruction of the sovereignty and the culture of the United States, as soon as we understand that there are forces working behind the scenes that have no loyalty to America but to the internationalist dream, then everything makes sense. Otherwise, none of this makes sense. The fact we're not trying to close our borders, the fact that we are doing everything we can to force the states to provide all sorts of welfare benefits and subsidies to people who come here illegally and violate our laws. I mean, if you are an illegal alien living in California, you can go to our universities and be subsidized by the state, and you'll get a far lower tuition than an American citizen coming into California and wanting to go to our universities from, say, Oregon or Nevada. Why do we give preference to the illegal aliens? Why, very simply, because that's part of the plan. We want to be a magnet. We want to draw them in here. And we are effectively drawing these people from south of the border who live in a chaotic country into our country. And that is part of the plan. It's being financed in large part by the Ford Foundation. And we carry a book on that. And until people understand that our government is refusing, our leaders are refusing to actually enforce our laws, because this is what the real plan is, only then can you begin to understand what's really going on. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that a secondary reason for inviting or making it an inviting place for illegal aliens to cross into is to water down the conservative population here to create a great deal of voters who are sympathetic towards the Latin cause. I think we're already
hold on for just a moment, Andrew. We bring our stations back up. Okay, our guest this evening is Andrew Skousen. He's just saying that what is going on as far as the federal government's policy, they say one thing and they do exactly the other, and they're actually encouraging immigration. And Andrew's point, one point was they want, of course, a lot of more people so they can come in here, so they can vote to change the culture and this our society. This is part of a long-range plan. Both political parties are involved. Destruction of America's sovereignty, destruction of America's culture, destruction of America's independence, the New World Order, the New World Religion. So go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, it's actually a very powerful force. Right now, you'll notice, especially in California, as well as in almost all of the southern states, a great many things can be are offered up by politicians specifically towards Spanish-speaking constituencies to pander towards these groups, because they are making up such a large portion of the voting population now.
But they're making up a large part of the voting population because they've been encouraged to come in here illegally.
Right.
They've been rewarded from coming in illegally by being a given immigrant status, you know, being a legal status. They did that, a decade or so ago.
That's
and now
right.
They want to do it again. George Bush wants to do it again. Unfortunately, there's too much opposition, but they'll find some other means of arranging this.
That's right. They'll call it something else and get it back. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wanted to concentrate a little bit further south of Mexico and our own borders, if you don't mind the transition here.
You go right ahead.
Let's talk briefly about some of the major countries in South America and what's happening. First off, in Cuba. Fidel Castro is still, of course, deeply entrenched in Cuba and is the prime basis for fomenting much of the Latin American insurgency down there since the 1960s. I think an important point that historically we should review with the listeners is that in the 1960s, JFK secretly signed a deal with Russia during the Cuban Missile Crisis to refrain from seeking Castro's removal if Russia pulled out its intermediate-range missiles. Now, this was a secret agreement that was put in place, and it gave Castro basically free rein in Latin America, free from U.S. retribution. And so this has given Cuba its status. It's been working in this kind of free fenced off area for itself for a long time, but Castro is starting to get old now. The Cuban regime probably in our analysis won't actually moderate after Castro dies. They will probably fake it. They would probably make a few token attempts to make it look like there's some free market reforms, sort of like Russia is doing now. But we think that the leftist forces in our own Congress, in the U.S. Congress, will succeed in their attempts to use that as an excuse to lift all the sanctions against Cuba. And then Cuba will start to prosper, will start to get a certain amount of success, but still harbor its same intentions about the creating and fomenting more of the Marxist insurgency among the Latin American countries. And so after Castro dies, it will actually become a more powerful force in South America. As it is now, it is already a large influence both in Brazil and in Venezuela, which are currently the two most powerful economic powers in Latin America.
You're talking about Fidel Castro's influence there.
Yes,
okay.
Exactly. So switching to Brazil, we have Brazil's president, Lula da Silva, who is quite good, quite honestly, at playing both sides. He's on one hand working to build a new he panders to the U.S. And tries to play face with us and with the media, And on the other hand, he's working to build a sort of a new Soviet-styled union of South American states. He's holding regular conferences with other Marxist leaders and helping plan Marxist revolutions. But he knows that he still has to play up to the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, in order to keep enticing international investments to come his way. He's got to buy off the wealthy capitalists in Brazil. He's got to keep the benefits going so as to keep the center and the right opposition sort of anesthetized and still put to sleep with apathy toward these changes that is slowly implementing in Brazil. And then in Venezuela, in Brazil we've got Lula, who is the Marxist ringleader, basically, and then in Venezuela we have Hugo Chavez, and he's pretty much the new bad boy on the communist bloc in Latin America. He's outright and brazen. He takes every opportunity he can to brandish his pro-Castro proclivities and lash out at the so-called Yankee monster up to the north, which is of course us in the United States. And interesting thing is that he is trying hard to undermine the oil connections between the United States and Venezuela. He is actively signing every oil contract he can around the world so that he can ship his supplies away from the U.S. as soon as he can. Few people know that he even has his two very profitable Citgo oil refineries up for sale in the United States, which is a telltale sign, of course, that he intends to stop shipping oil to these refineries as soon as he can get them sold. So he's working as quickly as he can to cut off ties with the United States. And
that will have a profound impact on our economy if we lose the Venezuelan source of oil, because of course
it would.
We could
not
have
to mention our gas prices, right, which are already considerably high.
Right.
And this is creating quite a few waves, even though the U.S. State Department is keen on fomenting problems so that they can encourage intervention and things. I think Chavez has been making a little bit too much out of this. Even the U.S. State Department is getting concerned about his moves to buy, for instance, recently when he bought so many of the Russian and Brazilian weapons far in excess of the needs.
He bought about 100,000 AK-47.
100,000 AK-47. Yeah, exactly.
For a 30,000-man army. So obviously he has other plans.
Right. But we think in the World Affairs Brief that it's possible that Chavez is actually going to overextend himself. He's creating not only waves outside of his country, but inside of his country as well. And he's turning into a very vociferous and almost rabid communist there. And he's alienating himself a little bit from the people of the country itself.
Oh, isn't he actually nationalizing some of the farms and other holdings of some of the people there?
He is, which is creating some discontent as well.
Some of the largest farms, he's just saying, if you're going to have to give me a reason why we shouldn't confiscate them. He's doing exactly what Mugabe is doing over in Rhodesia.
Yeah, scary stuff when property rights start to get lost.
Right. And we're not hearing about this, and this is not being talked about, but this is actually what's going on in Venezuela today.
Right. So we think that, in fact, Chavez may find himself being taken down. The U.S. globalists actually like to take down rabid communists and replace them with the sort of refined globalists who know how to put on faces and charades and play both sides of the fence more. And it's very possible that we'll see this happen with Chavez here. Not that the direction of the country will change, but shall we say the speed in which it is going there will change. It's something that is fairly common that when through deprivations caused by someone like Chavez, it's fairly easy to get them ousted and put in someone else that people otherwise wouldn't vote for. And so I think that they're going to let Chavez take this past what he probably ought to for his own good, and then replace him with someone else of the globalist choosing.
Well, I know one of the articles you ran was referring to a former officer in the Venezuelan army who has just fled the country really for his life and is living incommunicado in another South American country. And you know, of course, the only thing that can replace Chavez is his own military rising up against him. And of course, I don't think he's going to allow any fair elections there. So, but if the good people in the army are fleeing, then what chance is there?
Right. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how that happens, if it does happen. Yeah.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to have to take a break here. And, of course, when we get back, why we'll invite your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Andrew gives us an analysis of what's going on in Central and South America. We live in a very, very volatile continent. The average American is not having their attention focused on the implications of what happens as Hugo Chavez draws closer and closer to communist China and cuts off, our supply of oil, which I think is our second or third largest supply of oil from overseas. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Go ahead, Andrew. Pick up the story from there.
All right. Well, let's jump to Colombia now. So recently, Condoleezza Rice, our Secretary of State, has been traveling around in South America, and she recently announced millions more in aid to the Uribe government, who is currently in power there. Now, this particular government in Colombia is fairly pro-U.S., hence why they're receiving a lot of the benefits of monetary aid. She of course praised Colombia's progress in extraditing increasing numbers of drug lords to the U.S. for prosecution, which brings up an interesting point that many of the readers of the brief will have heard about, and that is that there's a lot being said here that a lot behind the lines of what is being said here. In fact, there's a turf battle that is going on in the Colombian drug trade. The CIA captured about 80% of the trade after toppling the Cali cartel. But there's always an ever-increasing crop of drug lords who pop up in these countries who are trying to compete for a share of the take of the very lucrative drug market.
Now, what you're in essence is saying is that the CIA is involved with the drug market in South America, as they're involved with the drug market over in Afghanistan, and they are the dominant, they control 80% of the drugs there, and is this war in the Colombia really to put down the competition to the CIA?
I'm saying exactly that the CIA is actively running drugs themselves. That's part of the source for the money of the dark side operations of the government. That the CIA is using the war on drugs as an excuse to only take out those people who are in competition with them in bringing drugs to the United States and to the rest of the world.
And I think that's so hard for the average American to accept is the fact that the CIA is involved in the drug market. And yet, I was just reading an article before we came on the air, and it was talking about Afghanistan. There are 358,000 acres of opium in Afghanistan today, which is controlled by the United States and by United States forces. Now, we have satellites that can read a newspaper from outer space. You mean they can't pick up where that 358,000 acres of opium is being grown in that country and stop the opium trade? the Taliban did. We're incapable of doing it. And I think people have to ask yourself, that isn't logical. I mean, if there are 358,000 acres and our troops are stationed all throughout that country, why can't we stop the drug trade? And the answer is, we have no intention of stopping the drug trade in Afghanistan or, as Andrew was saying, in Colombia. Because the CIA, the dark side of our government, is involved in drug smuggling just exactly as it was in the drug smuggling in Southeast Asia 30 years ago, 40 years
ago. That's right.
Go ahead.
That's right.
Go ahead, Andrew. So I just wanted to try to put that perspective for a lot of people out there who find it difficult to believe that our government, CIA, is involved in drugs. If you haven't read the book Drugging America, which we carry, Defrauding America, and I know Joel Skousen recommends both of those, or heard our four tape set on Is There Really a War on Drugs? You need to get that information. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Andrew was simply saying in Colombia, why the CIA controls about 80% of the drug trafficking. Let me repeat that, and I think I'm quoting him correctly. In Colombia, the CIA controls about 80% of the drug trafficking. The war in Colombia is not to stop the drugs. It's to stop the competition. So pick up the story there.
No, that's a very good point, and I appreciate you bringing up the point about Afghanistan. I think that Afghanistan is one of the biggest indicators of the U.S. involvement in drugs. In fact, it wasn't until after the U.S. toppled the Taliban that Afghanistan became the highest producing area of heroin in the world, which is very suspicious. And yeah, so it's also a problem in Colombia. Switching gears, I'd like to talk about the Organization of American States. This is the OAS, and basically this is all the independent nations in the Western Hemisphere except Cuba. There's a majority of Latin American nations, Brazil, Venezuela, Peru, Chile, Argentina, Panama, and Uruguay, all of which have leftist and Marxist presidents, and these people are determined to band together to find a way to come together to kind of form their own European Union.
That's sort of like a common trade zone, like we're trying to do with NAFTA, right?
Right, and so the United States is trying to encourage the FTAA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas. And all of the Marxist countries are trying to band together and create an opposition coalition type government to offset and to compete against this. During this Organization of American States, there's a Chilean whose candidate is a foreign minister. His name is José Miguel Insulza. And he's one of the top two vying for the slot. It's a difficult spot to vie for because there are certain countries that are pro-U.S. and so you have to be careful not to alienate those in order to get voted into this position, as well as a lot of countries that are Marxist. Now, this particular person is a leftist who is playing moderate toward the U.S. in order to win the position. But he has to disavow some of the Venezuelan support in order to get it. Latin America is determined to break loose of U.S. dominance over this organization, the OAS. And our analysis seems to indicate that Insulza is probably going to win. He's tied right now, 17 votes to 17 votes, with the globalist Mexican foreign minister, who is Ernesto Derbez, who is a close ally of course, of Vicente Fox. So we'll have to see what happens there. But switching back to this competition that's going on between the FTAA and the coalition that the South American countries are trying to pull together.
And for our listeners, the FTAA is what the United States wants to have. That's the free trade zone of the area, the Americas, which we will dominate. And then, of course, this other program, which is being pushed by Lula in Brazil, which will be a free trade zone that they will control and Brazil will dominate in South and Central America. Would that be correct?
That's right. That's right. There was in last December, some of the key members of the trading bloc that are very powerful down in South America met in Cusco, Peru, to form what they call the Cusco Declaration. In this declaration, 12 South American nations agreed to merge the region's two main trading blocs, the Andean Community of Nations, CAN, and the Southern Common Market called Mercosur. And they were trying to combine this into a single unified bloc called the South American Community Nations, the CSN. The Secretary General of this Cusco meeting stated that he wanted this group to be a mirror of the European Union, together with all of its institutions. So this group is trying right now to create a kind of a European Union amongst themselves, in opposition to sort of what the U.S. is trying to impose on them with the FTAA.
But, of course, neither one is good, because it means that both, in both, whether it's the American Free Trade Union or the South American Free Trade Union, the nations will give up their sovereignty to this internationalist organization. It is a stepping stone towards the New World Order, the New World Religion. We'll be right back with Andrew Skousen, and welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and right now, of course, our guest is Andrew Skousen. We have Eric calling from Compton. Eric, did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I do. Hello, Mr. Skousen.
Hi there.
Back in the early 70s, there was a very good book written, and it was called The Naked Capitalist. It was a commentary on Carol Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, which Dr. Stan is very familiar with. It was reviewed by W. Cleon Skousen.
Yeah, well, that was, of course, that's his great uncle.
That was my question. Were you related?
Yes, I'm. I am related.
Now, what was he a great uncle, Andrew?
Uh-huh. My great uncle, my dad's uncle.
Right.
Right.
And so that.
And he has written quite a bit of books, quite a few books.
In fact, I have one of them right here next to me. It's called The Making of America by Cleon Skousen. I keep it very, very close to where I'm sitting. But that was a wonderful book Cleon wrote, of course, The Naked Communist, The Naked Capitalist. And that Naked Capitalist was a wonderful book because it really went into the background of of this invisible government that rules the world.
That's right.
Anything else, Eric?
That was my only question.
Okay,
I was
thanks
curious.
So much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, go ahead and pick up the story there, Andrew.
All right. Well, as we were saying, the Secretary General of this meeting at Cusco said, quote, "Our ultimate goal is the United States of South America." The former Argentine President, Eduardo Duhalde, also said, "Our mirror will be the European Union with all its institutions." We think that Duhalde is parroting Lula da Silva's stated goal of forming a Soviet Union of South American states, with the same loss of sovereignty that the EU and the Soviets are trying to achieve.
And you're
another
go ahead.
Yes, go ahead.
No,
okay,
go ahead.
Well, one of the other Marxists, the Peruvian president, Alejandro Toledo, invoked, the brash language of Hugo Chavez when he said, quote, "We are here to give flesh, bone, soul, heart, and life to the dream of Bolivar." My father comments that the image of the liberator Bolivar, who was in fact a very liberal of the original libertarian variety, has sort of been hijacked by the Marxist machine to draw peasants into supporting Chavez's new socialist agenda.
And, of course, really what is so interesting about this whole thing is that you have these two forces in opposition. One, the American-backed FTAA, and then, of course, to counter that, why this desire for an independent, United States of South America. But in both instances, why the people lose their freedom, and who speaks for freedom for the people of South America? No one. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is Andrew Skousen. We were recently discussing what's going on in South America, the effort to create a United States of South America. And, of course, it's being led by Lulu, by the Marxists down there, and they're saying, look, if we don't join together and form a free trade zone here, United States of South America, why, we're going to come under the domination of the wicked Yankees up north. And so, to maintain our freedom, why we've got to go into this United States of South America and give up this national sovereignty of the various nations, first of all in a free trade zone, and then a common currency, and then of course a common government. But you see, that's how they're going to prevent America's dominance. And what people don't understand, it's all, in my estimation, a scam. You've got these two forces in opposition. The Americans, who are really resented by many people in South America, and then the Marxists. Which side do you want to be on? And my suggestion is, I don't want to be on either side. I don't want America to dominate South America. I don't want the Marxists to dominate South America. I want the people to have an opportunity to be free, but they're really not being given that option, are they, Andrew?
That's a very good point, Dr. Stan. In fact, what we have here are two evil organizations sort of fighting it out, and it's a very difficult situation for the people of these countries because instead of having a good force versus a bad force, they're basically forced to choose between two evils, and I don't think that there's any way out of it for at least not with the two major options that are being pushed right now. We've got turf wars going on between the U.S. and the Soviet-Chinese axis, and it's going to be very interesting what happens with the final outcome here in South America.
And I think that if people understand how both sides are being manipulated and the people are simply pawns in this vicious game, then you can begin to look independently. Before we go on, Andrew, I want you to get out your telephone number, your web space, so that people will know how to get hold of World Affairs Brief, how to get hold of a copy of your dad's weekly commentary, and how to subscribe to it if they'd like to.
Excellent idea. I appreciate it. All right. They can contact to get a free copy of the World Affairs Brief, a free copy of the print edition, by calling toll-free area code 877-518-5888. That's toll-free 1-877-518-5888. They can also log online to worldaffairsbrief.com. That's all spelled one word, worldaffairsbrief.com. And they can look at the website there, and like you said, Dr. Stan, they can look up daily stories. We sort of cull through all of the major news that comes through, and we put down what we think are the most important stories, and we provide links to the actual stories so people can use it as a page to get oriented and then click on the story that they're interested in and go and read those in their entirety. And then every week we come out with an in-depth analysis of the stories that we really think are the most important. And we put that out in our weekly World Affairs Brief, which is a weekly internet edition and sent out by email, and a monthly edition that is sent out by print for people who don't have access to email.
All right, fine. And let me recommend worldaffairsbrief.com. First thing in the morning, get onto that. Get the analysis of the news for that day. You'll be very gratified by what you see there. You read the summaries. If you're interested, pull down the articles. And I pull down probably half a dozen articles a day to keep on file. So pick up the story from there, Andrew.
Yeah, great. Thanks. Well, just to wrap up this story, although there are a lot of ties being formed in South America between the Marxist leaders and the anti-U.S. sentiment that's growing. I mean, for instance, Chavez and Castro are moving steps to challenge the FTA plan. Reuters recently reported that Venezuela is trying to create ties with Cuba to send some of their oil in that direction and help Cuba with its economy, at the same time divert oil from the U.S. sector, which they've been trying to find various other markets to pump to. And despite these ties that are going on, we think that it's going to be rather difficult for them to effectively challenge the FTA, and that is simply because of one thing, that if the U.S. is going to win with its FTA proposal, it's going to have to undermine the new Latin American rival, and it's not too difficult when it holds the purse strings. The IMF is a significant source of support for every one of these South American countries because of their socialist governments that rely on more money than they can pull in from their own people. And as a consequence, they're hooked onto the support of the U.S. backers. And so it's going to be a difficult thing for them to challenge. The people that hold the purse strings usually have the last say. So we think that the FTA is probably going to win out despite the turf war here.
Well, what happens if America, though, has a financial crisis? What happens, of course, if other countries begin moving away from the dollar? Won't that, of course, weaken our control over these countries?
That's a very good point. I think that that's a very good possibility, although with the way that the U.S. market drives the rest of the world economy, it'll be very difficult to make that change. But I think if they have any chance at all, it'll have to be through that venue. Yeah.
Well, it's going to be fascinating as we see this thing unfold, because there is a tremendous amount of hatred on the part of the Marxists for the United States. And, of course, FTAA is a plan of free trade zone in the Americas, which, of course, make America the major driving force behind this, and also, of course, hurt our economy and our workers even more, and transfer more of the wealth of the average American into these South American countries. So from the point of view of the South Americans, it's a lose-lose situation, but the point of view of the people of this country, it's a lose-lose situation for us. We were promised if we had NAFTA, we'd have all that wonderful market of Mexico. And look at all those people down there we can sell cars to, and we can sell refrigerators to, and we can sell all of these things that we produce. And now we're selling all those things to them, but they're produced in Mexico. They're not produced in the United States. And instead of having a positive balance of trade with Mexico, which we had, now we have a negative balance of trade with Mexico. And now, after they've lied to us about that, now they want to try to sell us on the free trade zone in the America. It's going to be interesting to see if Congress and the Senate are foolish enough to go along with this next step along the way towards the destruction of the sovereignty, the destruction of the economy of our country.
Yes, those are excellent points, Dr. Stan. There's a corollary story with Mexico I'd actually like to touch on while we're on the subject. Some of the readers of the World Affairs Brief have remembered last week's brief, or a recent brief, that talked about the controversy over Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Now, this is the Mexico City leftist mayor who is trying to run for president against President Luis Vicente Fox, and he was recently tried to be pushed aside and to be kept from taking part in the Mexican presidential elections because of a minor
he was charged with some sort of criminal activity. I've forgotten. Do you remember what it was?
Yes, here it is. It was about a minor real estate transaction that had gone on. I mean, we don't even know how real or how trumped up or how big it really was. But what has happened recently to bring the story back into the forefront is that President Vicente Fox recently fired his attorney general on Wednesday, and basically his attorney general was trying to knock out the most popular politician of that year, who was the Mexico City's mayor, Obrador. And it seemed like a very odd case for President Vicente Fox, who it seems stood to gain by having Obrador being kept out of the presidential race. Yeah. So we kind of have to analyze this a little bit more in depth. What happens is that there was quite a bit of intense pressure. Reuters reports that backing down to intense pressure, Fox fired Rafael Macedo, the attorney general who led the campaign to put Lopez Obrador on trial for contempt of court charges in a minor land dispute. He said, "My government will prevent no one from participating in the next federal election race."
Now, will, of course, will Vicente Fox be running in the next election or not?
I thought he was, but now that you mention it, I'm not sure.
So I think that basically the mayor of Mexico City is extremely popular with the people. He was going to run for the presidency. There was this effort on the part of the attorney general to charge him with some phony charges to keep him out of the race. And suddenly somebody has put pressure on Vicente Fox, the president of Mexico, to fire the attorney general so that the mayor of Mexico City then could participate. Now, do we have any idea who was behind that? And is the mayor of Mexico City part of this old a group that is, I think it was the PRI that's controlled Mexico for 50 years or more? Or is he an independent? Do we know?
President Vicente Fox is a member of the Conservative National Action Party.
What about the mayor of Mexico City?
And the mayor of Mexico City is a member of the PRI.
Okay, fine. Sure. So, and of course, this was the old Marxist, really a communist party that's been around going back to the 1930s. The communist revolution there, and they have controlled Mexico with the help of the United States ever since then, with all of the corruption that's been there, with the full help and support of our subsequent administration. So why in heaven's name would Vicente Fox, make an arrangement for somebody from the opposition party to run for the presidency?
Yes, and this is where the controversy seems to sort of break down. President Vicente Fox worked together with the PRA, the political party of Obrador, to combine for a majority of seats in the Mexican Congress. So why is it that Obrador's own leftist supporters would have joined with Fox in stripping Obrador of his chances of running for the presidency?
This is like the two-party system we have in the United States, where at the top they're both going exactly the same direction, financed and controlled by the same people, but to give the people the impression that we change something when we put in a new president, but the reality is nothing really changes as far as our foreign and domestic policy.
Right.
Is that going on in Mexico?
We think so. We think that this is quite possibly a ploy to bring Obrador into the forefront, to sort of make him look like he was taken advantage of in the media, so that he would gain popular support. I mean, he's already a very popular person in Mexico City and thus throughout Mexico. Now, because of this minor controversy, it seems like he was the victim here, and so a lot of people are hearing more about him through this, and so it's almost as if this were scripted, and that this is a sort of roundabout way to give him more media attention, to bring the PRI back to power. And we think that this is the only explanation about why the PRI played along with this, that they had foreknowledge that this was a ploy to make this Obrador out to be a martyr. But things won't be too good if Obrador does win. I think that we're going to see Mexico turn very far left. They will probably join forces with Chavez and start to play hardball with the U.S. over oil as well. And it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. But it's very possible that the U.S. Obrador will actually come into power here.
So that would give us another Marxist state right on our very borders.
Right. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what happens.
And I agree with you, your interpretation. I think that so many of these things are scripted, and if you look at them, they really don't make sense. It doesn't make sense that we're doing everything we can to build up the Chinese economy when they're in full production for war and threatening the United States. Just doesn't make sense if what we're seeing is the truth, but maybe we're all seeing is all of an illusion. And I think the same thing is true with so much of what's going on in South America. That maybe we're once again creating the best enemies that our money could buy, and the money that the CIA is making from the black operations is being put to good use. Who knows?
Yes, right. Yeah. So, in summary, here I think that South America is going to be a very interesting place to watch here in the next coming years, to see what there is going to be a pretty good indication of what will be tried to spread north to include us gradually, I think, through trade agreements and through these things. It's possible that they will try to include even the U.S. in these European Union-type groups and get the individual nations to give up more and more of their sovereignty and more of their individual status. It's being eroded from all sides.
And certainly our sovereignty has already been eroded by our acceptance of the North American Free Trade Association,
yes,
by our acceptance of the World Trade Organization, by certainly what's happening in Europe, and of course we even find our Supreme Court justices saying, well, we've got to begin to mold our laws in so that they are in compliance with the laws of the European Union. And you say, what sort of madness is this?
Yeah.
Not madness at all. If you understand that the ultimate goal is a one world government and a one world religion, then all of these little parts of the puzzle begin to fit together. If you look at them objectively, nothing makes any sense. But you see, you're not supposed to be able to connect the dots. Well, I'm hoping that what Andrew has said tonight, of course, will help you begin to connect the dots and begin to see the big picture. Not what they want you to see. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program. Well, Andrew, we've got 3 minutes. Why don't you? What would you like to talk about?
Well, let me briefly summarize the Bush Social Security agenda. I think this is a very interesting thing, because President Bush is taking great pains to expand this agenda and to give it a lot of press. Spending a lot of money on this, and it's rather contrary to what most people would think a politician would want to do. Politicians usually look for things that will appeal to the largest group of voters for them. Such is not the case with the Social Security agenda. In fact, most people don't want to touch the subject because there's hardly any way out of it. So despite all of the pressure of the war on terror and the stalemate war in Iraq and the powerful insurgency that's creating problems there, President Bush recently started a 60-stop speaking tour of the U.S. to promote his plan to put a token amount, 4%, of Social Security funds to convert them into private investment account. The president recently even asked for primetime TV time for a news conference to further push this fairly unpopular plan. So the real question is, why is President Bush pushing this? And our analysis thinks that given the two sides, the people who want to privatize Social Security and the people who want to keep it the way it is, it's not appeasing either one of these groups. Those of us, like myself, who wish that the Social Security was completely privatized and made voluntary, this token 4% plan is not going to help at all. Those who continue to want the socialized benefits that they paid handsomely for, and which they may have a right to, don't want this Ponzi scheme tampered with. In fact, it's interesting to note, just on a sidelight, that the Social Security Fund would probably still be fine if the federal government hadn't robbed it of its trillions in reserves since it was first created. But here's the point that we think is happening here, that the purpose of this plan is to pour additional funds into the weak stock market. The government is finding it increasingly difficult to sustain the stock market, even with massive injections by the government's quote-unquote plunge protection team. And they're constantly looking for more funds to boost up the markets. And
hold that thought for just a moment here.
Yeah.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Andrew Skousen, and he's saying that they feel that, of course, the plan that is being put forward by President Bush really is not what it appears to be. It is a plan, of course, to create these independent accounts, and then they're going to be invested into the stock market. And it is a scam to put more money in to try to keep the stock market going, or perhaps people will invest their money in the stock market, and the stock market plunges. Why, these people are going to lose an awful lot. But, of course, Joel Skousen seems to believe that the Bush administration is trying to stabilize the stock market by making so much more money available for investment, and that's the purpose behind is pushing the Social Security, not trying to protect the workers, but trying to protect the stock market. Would that be a fair statement?
That's right. And in addition to that, we think that more than likely the Social Security money will have to be put apart for specific government-approved stocks. And very likely we'll see quite a few people become very rich off of the insider dealings that this extra money will carry with it. One last point about Social Security. One of the band-aids that President Bush is encouraging right now, suggested by a Democrat, Robert Posen, is what's called progressive indexation. This is just for those people who think that President Bush is out there encouraging privatization of Social Security. This is a very good indication of his actual leanings in this matter. What progressive indexation does is it extends the solvency of Social Security because they're going to create a means test so that wealthy people who pay the most Social Security taxes will get even less of that back from all of the thousands that they pour in. Essentially, it turns Social Security into a true welfare program, and it's going to lose all pretenses of it being an insurance system. That is what they sold it to the American people. So we just have to watch out. President Bush is really not trying to privatize this year.
Well, my suggestion is we raise the retirement age up to 85 for Medicare and Social Security. We wouldn't have any problems at all. Andrew, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always been my pleasure to have you, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
Great, thanks.
Thanks very much. All right, well, I guess it's been Andrew Skousen, raised some very, very fascinating issues, and, of course, I hope that you'll consider them. Nothing is as it appears to be. And when you understand that, then it all begins to make sense, because if you're looking at what's going on in the world today, and you believe what the talking heads will tell you on television, and what you're going to hear on most talk radio, why, you're going to be sadly led astray. Let me suggest a couple of those books we've talked about in the past that will help you to understand what's going on. Certainly The Creature from Jekyll Island, which we carry, will help to explain the finances of what's going on. The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, Fiat Money Inflation in France. And my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. or the Brotherhood of Darkness special, with the book, the video. And so once again, The Creature from Jekyll Island, fiat money inflation in France, the Federal Reserve Conspiracy, and why my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. All available by calling, if you'd like more information, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like, of course, to understand the monetary system and the spiritual forces behind what's going on economically, get hold of my newsletters from last month. That would be the September and October newsletters for the year 2004. I believe that's September and October 2004 newsletters. And if you read those through, you'll know more about economics than most professors. I will be speaking in Southern California on next Wednesday and next Thursday. If you need more information on that, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's next Wednesday and Thursday. Wednesday in Orange County, Thursday in Tarzana, and we'd love to see you there. And then pray for America, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. We'll be with you on Monday again.